Chris Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to Nailers Netter in association with the Teacher Development Trust and now proudly sponsored by John Cat Educational. So this week I'm incredibly excited as David Weston is in the interviewer's chair, finally landing one of the biggest educational fish in the pond, Mr. Tom Bennett. And as Tom mentions at the end of the interview with David, I have been pursuing him for a long time, but the reality of the day-to-day job and, of course, Tom's day-to-day work means it's tricky to squeeze in a podcast in the evening, so I'm extremely grateful for David and Tom for this interview. And what an interview it is. So David Weston is Paxman to my slightly more gentle Parkinson. So he's asking the questions that I know you, the listener, would want asking. So he addresses the behaviour and some of the controversies within behaviour, and he also discusses Twitter and social media more widely. There are also discussions on the nightclubs of Soho and Chelsea, blind date, philosophy degrees, and of course, research ed. This week we have the welcome return of the podcast pedagogy section, where I'll be previewing teaching walkthroughs by Tom Sherrington and Oliver Caviglioli. In films, I'll be discussing Onward, which is Disney's latest family animation. In music, I'm going back to the 90s again for Portishead's Dummy, which is one of my favourite albums to listen to while I'm working late in the evenings. So without further ado, let's start talking to teachers. So over to Tom Bennett and our own Mr. David Weston. Over to you, David.
Thanks very much, Phil, and it's my pleasure to introduce Tom Bennett. Tom is one of the most well-known figures in education for his work on research and behaviour, and it's an absolute pleasure to be joined by one of the most influential voices in education today. Tom, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure, David. It's a pleasure to be here at last.
Well, yes, indeed, and a pleasure for me to be taking over from the inimitable Phil, while I interview you today. So, listen, I know sometimes people joke that you've often told your story, but do you know what? I think there are quite a lot of listeners who won't know how you got into doing all of this. So could you just share with us a little bit of your story, how you got into teaching and how you suddenly ended up doing all this work with research ed and behaviour?
Yeah, sure. For the last three people in the world that haven't heard this. So, as has often been said before, I was working in nightclubs. I was literally a cocktail waitress in a waitress cocktail bar, running nightclubs in Soho, and I was doing that for about 6 or 7 years, and also in Chelsea in London, and it's a great career, but it's a terrible career, and it's very much a young man's game, and it's intense, and it was great fun when you're young, but there was a strong sense of burnout, and I remember seeing an advert which said, use your head, teach. You know, do you remember? You're old enough to remember.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like a light went off in my head. I just thought to myself, this is exactly what I should be doing. You know, it was like a sudden realization. So I went to do the teacher training while I was still running clubs, I might add. So that was an interesting 7 days a week I had there. Five days a week I was in schools, and then on Saturday and Sunday I was working in restaurants and clubs. And it was just such a brilliant thing. I just absolutely adored it. I loved it. And before that, I did a philosophy degree because that's where all the big bucks were, apparently. And you know,
it's a completely standard career then. Philosophy degree, nightclubs, teaching.
To be honest, you know, arts degree, low income job isn't probably as uncommon as you might think. So that's what it was. Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly simple button. Then I became a teacher, and then I was teaching for about 8 or 9 years before I started to write seriously. And it's the classic kind of rags to riches, American dream story. I started to blog a lot, and I found my voice through that. And then I started to get on social media, started to find my voice through that. And then it kind of one thing led to another, and then it became a kind of a columns in the TES and writing behaviour for the TES, and then that led into behaviour consultancy, and lo and behold, here I am now.
Here you are now, although you've left out the incredibly important aspect of being on blind date.
Well, to be honest, I was building up to that. That was that was something I did when I was I think I was 20. when I was on Blind Day, older listeners will remember Cilla Black's, opus. And at the time, it was the most watched thing on television. So it was extraordinary. I remember when I did that, I was walking down the street and people would constantly recognise you. It was the strangest, it was the oddest thing. But, long since the past. One thing I will say about that, though, is that that was a long time ago. And then I think it was about 3 or 4 years into my teaching career. And one of the kids at my school said, "Sir, were you on Blind Date?" And I went, how on earth did you find out about this? I mean, this is before the internet had really kicked in. And people could kind of find this kind of stuff. And they said, "Oh, it's on UK Gold." It was on UK Gold. And then somebody taped it, and then there's a professor in the school. So, I was beaten twice with the same stick.
You know, you've really made it when your TV appearance is on UK Gold.
That got me so much credit with the kids, though. It was the weirdest thing. You know, they thought that was really cool because you'd been on telly, which is quite.
Well, strange. So that's going to be a piece of advice in a new behaviour report. Get yourself on Blind Date and wait for it to be on UK.
Blind Date. To be honest, I think Charlie Taylor did exactly the same thing.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the standard career route once again. So, Tom, you taught, as you say, you found your voice, and I remember sort of back in the sort of the early 2010s, as it were, the sort of the Twitter community was, really vibrant and exciting. Sort of as you went through that, obviously you became more and more of this authority around behaviour. So what was the story there? How did you suddenly find yourself becoming this authority around behaviour and beginning to do guidance and being asked to work with the department?
Well, yeah, listen, I have to put this caveat in right at the start. It's very difficult to know what makes anybody an expert in behaviour. There's no one career path. There's no one degree that you can do that will make you an expert in managing and directing the behaviour of classrooms. There's a multitude of things that can make you good and better at it. And I have to say right from the start, I was terrible at behaviour management when I started to be a teacher. In fact, in many ways, that was my catalyst to try to get better because, I mean, I was already 31 years old or something, or 32 when I started to teach, already a very old man. And, I was confident. I'd run nightclubs. I could talk down drunks and all kinds of stuff. And then I came to the classroom and I thought that it would be relatively easy because of that. And I just found how enormously wrong I was and how difficult it was to manage the behaviour of children who don't want to be managed. And it's not just as simple as asking them in a really nice, kind and interesting way. And it's not about presenting the material that's fundamentally interesting because nothing is intrinsically interesting to everyone. And it's certainly not about shouting the loudest or being the nicest. There were so many things that it wasn't. And I realised I was woefully underprepared to run behaviour in classrooms and that to some extent I hadn't been taught or trained to manage and direct the behaviour of classrooms of children. And it took me a few years beyond that to realise what a travesty that was, what a frailty and a weakness and a fragility this was right at the core of what it meant to be a teacher and what ITE and teacher training was about. So I remember I started to do what a lot of teachers do, which is I started to learn how to survive, which is simply means to cope, which doesn't mean to thrive or flourish, but just to get through the day. Mm. And because of that, I developed all kinds of tricks and habits of my own, some of which were useful, some of which weren't. I mean, one of the things I learned very early on was that I started to learn that I could get their attention a wee bit if I started to tell a story. And I think the narrative is a very useful device to use behaviourally, but it's very tricky to get right. As it happens, I was quite good at it. But I wasn't good at a lot of other things. So I told stories and then kind of, suddenly slipped in some Descartes and hoped they wouldn't notice. So I learned good habits and bad. And I started to read all the behaviour books that were out there, and I read all the classics and the Bill Rogers and so on. And some of them were really good and some of them were just atrocious. And some of them advanced you to ridiculous things. I mean, a story I frequently tell is that in my early days, one of my mentors said to me, take your very challenging class and take the most difficult pupil and put them in charge of the class. I said, why? And said, well, just give it a try. I think it was an empathy exercise, So I put this girl in the class and she tore me to pieces and for about 40 minutes. And the guy in the class said to me, why are you doing this? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I told my mentor afterwards how badly it had gone. He says, oh, that's really bad. And I said to him, so what happened when you did it? And he says, well, I've never done it. This is the ecosystem I find myself in. So I read all the books I could. I went on loads and loads of training days. And I always kind of asked the schools to put me in on them. And I found that they often had some similarities and some dissimilarities. So I just started to write my own advice. I started to write about behaviour.
Yeah.
And, you know, I found my own voice. It was very experiential, and it was as evidence-informed as I could make it. But back in those days, evidence usage was much thinner. That then led to a job writing about behaviour for the TES. And it wasn't meant to be super authoritative, like, I have your answer. It was more meant to be, I've been through the same problems you've been. I've not been excellent either. Here's what I did to try and cope with it. Here's what other people have done. And so it was, I hope there was a huge amount of humility there. And from that, it became a behaviour advisor on the TES website. And then I started to write all the behaviour articles for them, which was great, a fantastic opportunity. And from that, I started to get invited to schools to speak about it. And then I started to observe schools and started to see what they were doing. And that was another great rubric I managed to cross, where I started to get into schools, other schools, lots of them, and to see behaviour practices. And it kind of, you know, it kind of grew from there. And so I think the only superpower I've got, David, and I don't have many, I assure you, apart from the fact that I can fix a print, I can fix a photocopier jam like nobody else on the earth I know, is that I've seen lots of schools, good and bad. And I must have seen about 400 schools now. I was counting it the other day. And I specifically look at their behaviour systems. So I've been very, very privileged to see lots of systems at work, and I've tried to glean what they do from that.
So I'd love to ask sort of some practical tips in a moment, but let me go back for a moment, because in 2017 you released the Creating a Culture report with
the Department of First Album. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Tell us a little bit about the process of creating that, and maybe also a little bit about the research that was behind it.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So about a year or so prior to that, I gave it evidence at the Carter Review when they were looking, amongst other things, teacher training and any deficits there. And the Carter Review recommended that more work be done in the field of behaviour management for teacher training, which obviously I sell. I was asked by Nicky Morgan, I believe, to conduct a review of initial teacher education in terms of behaviour subsequent to the Carter Review. So we did a review of ITE, and we found that while there was some great training going out there, there was also a lot of terrible stuff. And it was also thin and patchy. And and this is no discredit to the ITE community, to the teacher training community, but nationally, it's not a great picture. That, you know, if you're unlucky like me, you'll get a 45-minute behaviour lecture. And then good luck as you go along. So that wasn't very, that was pretty suboptimal. And then subsequent to that, I was asked by Secretary of State Nicky Morgan to write a report into what schools were doing, because it became obvious that while teacher training was an enormous lever that could be used to raise the standards of behaviour management, that what seemed to be very apparent very quickly was that what seemed to really matter in schools was the quality of the leadership in a school. Because the leader, I mean, teacher training is one thing, but teacher induction and continuing professional development, which I know is right up your street, is absolutely crucial to the creation and the maintenance of an effective, healthy, positive and flourishing school culture, behaviourally or otherwise. So we looked at leadership. And so what we did was we went to as many schools as we could that were inclusive, comprehensive, with a challenging demographic and great behaviour. And those four caveats were terribly important to us. We weren't terribly interested to find out what, you know, Eton and Rugby are doing. And again, I'm not against these schools. I'm very, you know, delighted for their successes. But when you take the most fortunate, affluent, and, you know, already well-behaved and probably, you know, articulate demographic in the UK, and you put them together in one place, you tend to get fewer behaviour issues. And when you've got... And, you know, and obviously that's not to say that poverty is a cause of poor behaviour. Far from it. Nothing is so simple. But what we find is that families from very challenging socioeconomic circumstances tend to also feature many risk factors, which then correlate strongly to behavioural outcomes. So, you know, it's not a simple process, but we wanted to look at challenging schools that were inclusive and comprehensive to see what they were doing. And we visited as many as we could. We conducted lots of roundtables. We did peer review. We did teacher interviews. As I say, we went to as many schools as we possibly could. We also conducted a parallel strand of research, which we commissioned to go to other schools to ask roughly the same questions we were asking and to see if they came up with the same conclusions about what seemed to be the most effective factors in leadership in schools. To my relief, they largely did. So we then published. And speaking of somebody who runs Research Ed, I always have to bear this cross, which is that everything I do or say has to be as evidence-informed as I can possibly make it, which isn't to say that behaviour management can ever be fully articulated as an exact science. It will always be a conflation of qualitative and quantitative data. And so the best thing to do is to try to get out there into the field and see what people think works and to see if it is working for them. And then to try to triangulate that with, for example, what cognitive psychology is telling us about behavior, motivation, inclusiveness in groups, out groups, what social psychology is teaching us, what developmental psychology is teaching us. And then, you know, stir that pot together and come up with something and release it with a caveat, which is that this is as best as we can get, we think, but we leave it to you to discuss further. And I think when you match the certainty of your claim with the quality of the provenance of your evidence, that's when you have something like an honest and useful contribution to the educational debate. And perhaps I'm veering to research now, but I think when people overstate the evidence for their claims, then that's when we start to get in trouble in teaching. But that was roughly the genesis of that project. It took about 2 years, I might add, and it was entirely unpaid. I don't know what I was thinking, but I wanted it to be completely independent. You know, I didn't want this to be the government's advice. I wanted it to be, here's what we think works as best as possible in as many contexts as possible. We were looking for best bets and highly probables and most likelies, rather than this will definitely work in your school. We were looking for context, and we were looking to see what seemed to be unified between the schools. And we also wanted to see what was different about these schools. You know, when did context matter and when did people matter more? And that's why we were looking at coastal schools, rural, urban, suburban, primary, secondary, early years, alternative. You know, we went to as many as we could to see if there's a common thread. And we found quite a lot, I must say.
So, Tom, I'm kind of struck by, as I'm listening to you, that the... you have occasionally attracted a little controversy. I think it'd be fair to say. And what I find very interesting is listening to you talking about, very much talking about, we need to think about people, we need to think about context, we need to think about psychology, we need to think about how complex this is. Which what you're saying here seems very different in many ways to what you're often painted as saying. It's like, oh, it's very simple and, you know, this rule works.
That's a really interesting point, David. You know, I do reflect upon this, I've never in my life said it was simple. I mean, my God, if it was simple, we'd all be doing it. I've never in my life said that the weird thing is, if I'm honest, I think there's two reasons why we have this level of immaturity in the behaviour debate. One is that it's not been taught particularly well at the ITE level, which means that from a behavioural perspective, many teachers are coming at behaviour from a very intuitive perspective. So too are many people outside of the teaching profession. Many, I might add, of whom are the most prominent critics of behaviour management, although having had little experience themselves in any challenging school context. So there's that, and I think also leaders suffer because there's very little, if not no, guaranteed training in behaviour management at a strategic and whole school level. I mean, it exists, but it's very sporadic. So you basically have as an education system full of people who've got very strong opinions about behaviour, but there's not been a great deal of structural or academic provenance to sustain those opinions. So that's one reason why the behaviour debate is sometimes quite immature. You know, you say behaviour management to some people and they immediately think about the belt, you know, or pensions, and, you know, that's all that it's about. And the reason why that happens sometimes is because that's what they remember from their own experiences. And secondly, if I'm honest, there's a lot of people out there. I mean, you mentioned Twitter being a lovely, sweet place, and I think it was sweeter about 10 years ago, in social media in general, but that's because there were fewer people on it, and which meant there were more hobbyists, there was more nerds and geeks and aficionados. And now it's everyone. Everyone's there. And it's a bit like... Yeah. The comparison I make here is if you can think back to Professor X from the X-Men, although if you've seen the movie or the comics, and he's got this telepathic power where he can see everyone's thoughts, but sometimes it's a problem for him because he's overwhelmed by all the thoughts of everyone in the world. He knows what everybody's thinking at once. And that's us now. That's Twitter. You know what everybody's thinking. And so consequently, if I've you know, fire up the social media engines of a morning, you know. And I'm sure you're the same, David. You're a prominent, well-known figure too. You know, you'll get 500 comments of people just chatting about their lunch and people saying that they read your report and enjoyed it and asked if you could give some advice on behaviour. And then you'll get 40 or 50 people saying that you're Satan and why do you hate children? And you better watch your back. You know, it's the Wild West, which is why I curate it quite heavily for my own sanity. So, you know, there are people out there that get kind of really animated and they'll say things like, you know, you just want to put children in booths. And I feel like saying, have you ever read anything I've written? You know, and they're creating their own, it's the perfect straw man analogy. But honestly, I cannot be too bothered by it because there's too much important work to be done. So I really just turn that gas down to a peep and just get on with it and try to spread the word as best I can.
Right. Well, look, so in this is not going to be helpful at all then, because I want to talk about some of the specific controversies.
I'm happy to address them.
So look, let's pick a few, sort of have a brief look at some of these controversies that have gone around in particular. One of them would be the idea of zero tolerance, or some people say, no, it's not all about it's warm, strict. A good thing, bad thing, universal panacea. Yeah. What do you think?
Okay, I don't like the phrase zero tolerance at all. I've never have. This is one of the times when having a philosophy background is actually marginally useful. When you make a universal claim, you open yourself very easily to criticism and rhetorical exposure. Because if you say something works everywhere, and that you must never have an exception, for example, well, then it's very, very easy for people to come up with some exceptions very, very quickly, which it would appear to be inhumane or fundamentally cruel not to permit. For example, if you said that everybody had to hand in their homework, and then you said, but what if the child had been, you know, stabbed in the arm that morning or that night? You know, would you still be 100% zero, you know, zero tolerance? I mean, it'd be madness to say things like that. And but here's the interesting thing, David. I go to a lot of these so-called zero-tolerance schools, and I've never met one which is actually genuinely, sincerely zero-tolerance. You know, I mean, I even talked to some of the greats of the zero-tolerance, you know, movement, shall we say, and they'll say things like, you know, we expect our students to always bring in their work. And I'll say, well, what if they've been hit by a car? And they'll say, well, obviously not then. I'll say, well, then you're not zero-tolerance. And what we're left with then is simply very low tolerance for misbehaviour, which, to be honest, I do. Massively approve of it. I think, to be honest, that the consistency of your expectation is incredibly important. And I think that very frequently what we find in schools is a lot of teachers in schools, yes, being slightly too generous with students in terms of what's acceptable, and the kids think it's permitted. I'll give you a perfect example of this so it doesn't sound too draconian. If you say to your class, I expect all of you to hand in your homework tomorrow, and the class will nod along and think, well, that's the expectation, and then 50% of the class don't. And then you say to that 50% of the class, without any further investigation, oh, that's fine, just hand it in tomorrow. Then you've told the class that it's not 100% important to bring in your homework, that there will be tolerance and so on, there will be ambiguity. And again, that might be okay if that's what you're trying to convey, but what you shouldn't then say is we are zero tolerance. So very low tolerance is far better. And I think warm strict, I think it's actually a different idea. I don't think it's just another name for it. I mean, warm strict conveys so many other different things, which is to say that you treat people with dignity, you treat them with respect, you treat them like they matter, which is incredibly important for children, particularly children from more disadvantaged circumstances or dealing with, you know, emotional difficulties and so on. But at the same time, you're strict with them. And I don't mean strict in a kind of a Tom Brown school days way. I just simply mean, as in being punitive, I just simply mean that you expect it to happen, and if it doesn't happen, you do something about it. That's warm strict to me. So warm strict and zero tolerance are different things.
So, I mean, an interesting question, and obviously without naming any names, have you been to a school where, because you said it's about, you know, people being generous, with their understanding of children. Have you ever been to a school where you think, do you know what, they've gone too far and actually they're lacking humanity here, and actually I'd pull this back?
Honestly, David, never. And I have been to hundreds of schools, and I get invited to a lot and I get sent to a lot. So most of the times I get there and I'm asked to be there. So granted, there's going to be an element of let's be the best behaviour. But also at the same time, I sometimes get sent there for, you know, a variety of kind of deity type reasons. But I've never seen a school where I thought they were too punitive or too harsh, systematically anyway. I know, obviously, I see snapshots of schools. I think what you do sometimes find is you find some schools which are not schools as such, but you find that in individual circumstances, some teachers will give a detention out of anger. Or you'll find a school which isn't looking hard enough to try to uncover why a student is behaving the way they're behaving. That certainly happens. Mm. I've never seen a school where I would have thought, my God, this is, you know, this is like something from, you know, the Flashman novels. It's a weird thing. I think there appears to be different boundaries and levels of acceptability within schools. What we don't see, for example, anymore, certainly since the 60s or 70s, are real sink schools where the behaviour is atrocious and children are, you know, literally running about completely feral.
Mm.
And consequently, I think there's another side to that, which is we also don't see schools which are that strict anymore. And again, I think a lot of people are thinking back to perhaps their own school days or perhaps their grandparents' school days.
Right. So I mean, that's interesting because, you know, to say you've never seen a school that's sort of too punitive on the whole, but you've seen incidents.
Yeah, I mean, so 500,000 teachers and there's millions of school children, you know, we can't guarantee that they're all going to be handled very well. And also, given the poverty of training in behaviour management, I'd be very surprised if some teachers didn't overreact, absolutely.
So, I mean, does that suggest that everyone should generally be going stricter? I mean, you know, recently there's been coverage about whether the government actually wants everyone to have silent corridors and everyone to ban mobile phones. Should it be a universal?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there's very rarely anything which works equally well in every circumstance. But as I say, I do look for best bets and highly probables. I would say that mobile phone usage should be almost exclusively clamped down upon. I mean, there are some circumstances I've seen where students can use mobile phones sensibly and so on, but they tend to be incredibly mature students. They tend to be incredibly articulate students with high levels of self-regulation. You know, that could be a variety of ages, but normally slightly older students too, I might add. That as a learning tool, there are certainly utility. There is certainly utility in mobile phones, but the utility is normally massively outweighed by the detriments that most students experience, particularly the least advantaged and the least able students. And there's lots of research to support that these children are the most distracted by phones. And because of that, I think that one of the best things we can do with children, if you want to talk about teaching them appropriate usage, is to guarantee them a space where they don't have to be online for 6 hours out of the day. I don't think that's draconian. They can do, you know, if the parents are daft enough to give them a smartphone before they're 16 and they want to let them play about with it unsupervised outside of school hours, that's very much their concern. But in schools, I think it's our duty to provide them with the safest space possible. So I would broadly support, maybe, you know, perhaps not a legal ban, but certainly a, you know, in all but the rarest of circumstances type ban. When it comes to silent corridors, that's very, very different. My preference myself is very, very quiet corridors. I think schools should be entitled to have or expect or try to achieve silent corridors if they want to have them. I don't think it should be some kind of Ofsted prescribed requirements to get a certain grade. If students are walking down corridors habitually, civilly, socially, quickly and efficiently to their lessons, and they're chatting at a very, very low level while they do so, I mean, that would be fantastic. What we find silent corridors are more useful for are circumstances where the behaviour is very poor or there's some really challenging demographics within the school. And it's much simpler to simply say, right, we expect it to be silent, because it's a very clear thing to understand, it's a very clear thing to realise, and also to teach. And then once you've achieved that, perhaps after some time, you might then want to say, right, we will now try quiet corridors. In other circumstances, you might have children who are very able and very capable and self-regulate beautifully, so you might not want to stipulate silent corridors. So I think that while there was certainly a strong emphasis in the Secretary of State's statement, what he didn't say was that it would be an expectation that every school should have them.
Right. So, I mean, that's very clear as well. You kind of, you know, one of them is a more nuanced sort of, well, I think it works for people, and another one maybe around mobile phones is a little bit clearer. You suggest that most people didn't have the mounts. So there's an interesting question here. And I occasionally find it exhausting watching the behaviour debates with, you know, one side well, both sides characterizing the other as anti-children. And you know, that can be exhausting sometimes. But I think there is actually an interesting question here about exclusion and inclusion. And what do we do genuinely about the children and the families who really do struggle in schools where they have lower tolerance behavior systems? What do we do about that? And how are we balancing the sort of the collective right to a disruption-free education to the individual rights and also the collective good of not excluding people from the system?
That's an, oh gosh, enormous kind of one. So if you've got 3 hours, right, okay, I'll try to be brief. I don't think exclusions, when done properly, people talk about being as a necessary evil. I don't think they're a necessary evil, because if they're necessary, they're not an evil. And it's duplicitous to talk about it that way. I think that sometimes exclusion is absolutely the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. If a child brings in a knife with the intent to use it into a school, it is absolutely the moral thing to remove that child from the school. And can I just caveat, to put them into a circumstance where they can, to some extent, be supported away from those types of behaviours. Not simply, you know, evacuating them from the system, but taking them somewhere more appropriate for, shall we say, both their needs, but also the behaviour they exhibit. Because the children who are left behind in those types of circumstances absolutely have the right not to be exposed to people with knives. And it's madness to suggest otherwise. And the people who say, oh no, you shouldn't exclude, you should try and understand that child more, they would never allow their own children to be exposed to that type of violence or anxiety. They would never do
that. Okay.
So I get quite animated by that. But
yeah, I understand. What if we took a slightly less extreme example of the repeated low-level disruption?
Right.
This is a child maybe who has some special educational needs. Maybe there are family difficulties going on. Someone's going to have to support this family and this child.
Right.
How do we balance those needs? Because that feels trickier.
Absolutely. But only because it's trickier to support. I think the way to tackle this is to try not to take it too simplistically and just think that one side's good and one side's bad. I think when it comes to the exclusion debate, we very, very frequently forget all the other children in the class who have got a right to an education and find themselves having their education, I mean, often ruined by the behaviour of a small minority of children in the class. So that's why I believe in, you know, if children misbehave to the point where their behaviour can't be amended in the classroom, I do believe in the right to remove from the classroom. That's the first step. And then if that happens persistently, then it needs to go far beyond merely sanctioning. And it needs to go into how can we support these children? How can we try to see if we can address what's going on in their lives? Sometimes it's an unmet need, and sometimes it's a habit that they need to change. So there's different models to look at it. Sometimes you might want to use therapeutic approaches. Sometimes you might want to use more pastoral approaches. Sometimes you might want to use a blend of that with some punitive approaches to try to remind them that there are boundaries and so on. But the point is this, is that you can't just punish children into behaving. And that's why sanctions are only a small part of the behaviour management system of a school. However, if a child's behaviour is persistently disruptive to other students, I mean, when we say persistently disruptive, I mean, this is something we can say quite glibly. This can quite easily be someone telling the teacher to F off and throwing, you know, and pushing chairs over and making noises so that it was impossible for 30 other children to learn. You know, this isn't a small thing. This is harrowing if you're a teacher, and harrowing if you're a student in that environment. You know, children don't get removed or excluded from schools for asking for a pen. They just don't. They get excluded from schools for, you know, telling teachers to F off constantly, you know, breaking things, pushing things over and ruining lessons. It's never an easy option for the vast majority of schools. And while I'm sure there are some schools that probably have some fairly sharp practices in terms of over-excluding, to be honest, I just don't think it's a national issue. I think that that's probably quite small scale. I think the vast majority of schools desperately try to keep children in school. So children who've got difficulty adjusting to high expectations, they absolutely need lots of support adjusting to those high expectations. And crucially, and this is something which often gets missed in the argument, it's not so much about how you respond to misbehavior, it's how you cue up good behavior and how you teach good behavior. It's the proactive side of it. And this is a part of, behaviorism talks about this, but so do many other theories. The idea that you create an environment where it's more likely that students will behave. One of the ways in which we do this is by consciously, articulately, and compassionately teaching behavior. So this is what we want to do. Let's practice it. This is why we're doing it. All the little micro habits to make up good behavior. And that rising tide lifts all ships. It includes lots of children whose behaviour would normally escalate into deeper levels of misbehaviour. So it's the proactive teaching which actually helps children a lot more, and also helps help teachers understand to themselves what the norms and the rules are. So once you've done that, go on then, Perry.
Well, I was going to say, so, I mean, obviously, there is, you've criticised, in fact, I've criticised, certainly based on my own experience, that there have been certainly times when initial teacher education, people weren't prepared. I know on my PGCE, I had exactly, as you say, the kind of the 45-minute input on behaviour management, and I struggled. Where are universities or schools doing it really well? Have you seen some good examples where actually now in ITE, they're doing some fantastic preparation on behaviour management?
Yes, I have. I think that there has been an awakening. I think there has been a slow genesis of a new era, but it is very, very slow. I think there are several suppliers who are getting there. If I'm honest, I think behaviour management is very hard to train in a university-based environment. I think that a lot of the academic and instructional stuff can be done very, very well there. I still don't see that happening at a national level. I would say that there are green shoots of optimism. I see lots of great stuff going on in schools, particularly at the MAT level, if I'm honest, because they tend to have capacity to think about this at an articulate level. So I've seen quite a few MATs thinking very closely and clearly about their induction processes for new members of staff, but not just the induction processes, also their continuing professional development for existing members of staff. Because the idea that we can have a kind of fire and forget model of behavior, of training and behavior management needs to be consigned to the dustbin. You know, even if you're taught very well at the start of your career, which is a huge benefit and also still quite rare, you'll forget things, you'll fall into bad habits, you need boosters, you need people to talk about troubleshooting and snagging the problems that you do have. So the schools that are best at it have got a very long-term strategic vision about not just the teaching of behaviour management for induction and CPD for staff, but also the implementation and the kind of the what's the word I'm looking for, the when you repeat the training for staff on a regular basis. To sustain it, and that's when it becomes sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously you're talking the language I love now about, I mean, I guess, you know, we don't want fire and forget in anything, let alone behaviour.
Yes.
So I did want to come on a little bit. Uh-huh. It being me, I wanted to talk a bit more about CPD.
Of course.
And I guess that first thing about leadership, which you mentioned before, and people who've heard me speak will inevitably have heard me speak about a paper by Matt Craft and John Pape, where one of the aspects that was strongly correlated with whether teachers were improving or not was, and I quote, "the extent to which the school is a safe environment where rules are consistently enforced and administrators," which is American language for school leaders, "assist teachers in efforts to maintain an orderly classroom."
Yeah.
And it always struck me that if we want a disruption free environment where students feel safe to learn, then we need a disruption free environment where teachers feel safe to learn. So, but it is more than just what individual teachers do. That's a whole school system, isn't it?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, the whole reason about why we wrote the Creating a Culture report was because we acknowledged that leadership was the crucial lever in this whole process. And that if you could have 40 or 50 fantastic teaching staff or members of staff who were pretty good at de-escalating behaviour issues and so on, and they knew how to teach rules and routines and norms and whatnot. But if the schools run badly, if the school processes don't work, if the systems don't work, if things aren't escalated properly, if meetings don't happen, if external groups aren't accessed, and if parental stakeholders aren't accessed on a systematic level, then it all starts to fall apart. It's like having great doctors in a poorly run hospital. You know, people will still die because things aren't cleaned and, you know, the equipment isn't where it should be and operating theatres aren't available and so on. You know, it's a systematic thing. And in that type of system, people develop bad habits because they learn to cope rather than to flourish. And one of the things we found is that the leadership of these issues is when it becomes crucial, because it's leadership that determines when training happens and what type of training and to whom and when. It's leadership that determines when that's reinforced. That's the word I was looking for earlier on. It's leaders who determine what's acceptable boundaries and what's not. It's leaders who determine what are whole school red lines and what's allowed down to the teacher agency. And individual teachers by themselves can never manage public areas, which is, you know, a large part of the school. So, the, you know, the corridors, the dining hall, the assembly, the playground, the entrance and the exits and so on. But that has to be determined and decided in terms of standards by people who lead the system. And to be honest, there should also be a large amount of input from leaders as to what constitutes the correct shape of a lesson. I mean, it doesn't have to be in micro detail, but there should be some features and factors of it that teachers insist upon. So yeah, leadership is crucial to this. We also found that, a year and a half ago, I chaired a mental health panel for the DfE where we looked at the advice that was given to schools and head teachers on promoting good mental health in schools. And one of the things we kept coming back to, which was that teachers and school leaders are not professional medical experts themselves. So it's very difficult and dangerous, in fact, for them to diagnose or prescribe what should be done with children. But one of the things they can do safely and reliably, one of the best things and one of the key catalysts, is to create a calm, safe environment where people feel like they're treated with dignity and they feel safe to flourish. And in that type of environment, you know, things like stress and so on and other triggers are massively ameliorated.
Yeah, everything you're saying here is fascinating. Both I'm reflecting that there's some really interesting research on school turnaround by, believe it's Hitt and Myers. One of the things that looks at US principals is one of the very first things they set to establish when you're turning a school around and putting it back on a course of success is creating this safe environment where everyone, the teachers, all just feel safe. And it feels so important.
This kind of goes back to, I refer back to my useless philosophy degree. When you study the political philosophy or the philosophy of politics, you come across the idea of the social contract, which is that one of the reasons why we band together in societies and communities in the first place is because it's safer and we can do more and we can achieve more together as groups. But one of the ways in which that has to be facilitated is by agreeing some common norms of behaviour that groups cannot flourish unless they agree to certain common standards of behaviour so that they feel safe in order to do so. And that safety and security is at least one of the prime goals required of any leadership in order to achieve all the other wonderful ones. You know, security is not a goal in itself.
I mean, I think that's fascinating. And actually, I was reflecting recently on what it takes to get teachers to be really good. And actually, there's I don't know if you've seen, there's a really fantastic study from the Netherlands by, I think, Charlotte Wolf and colleagues. Mm-hmm. And essentially, she was talking about how novice teachers and expert teachers see classrooms differently. And I'll read out the quote in just a second, but it suggests to me that it's very hard for someone to progress beyond a novice teacher until they can deal with behavior issues. So the quote was this, it says, notably, teachers' cognitive processing diverged significantly based on expertise level. Yeah. Differences in focus included themes such as student learning discipline. Experts focused on learning in the classroom and the teacher's ability to influence learning, whereas novices were more concerned with maintaining discipline and behavioural norms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And isn't it fascinating? Because, I mean, that certainly resonates to me, where actually it was very hard for me to improve my craft of teaching until I could just, you know, to coin a book title from Sue Cowley, Get the Buggers to Behave.
I can't believe you said that. That's extraordinary. How offensive.
Great book, though. And I was so excited when I actually met Sue in real life. I couldn't quite believe it. But, you know, it is fascinating, isn't it? And, Tom, it feels like so much of this is foundational to getting our schools to work. But I suspect we still haven't heard the end of the controversy.
Well, no, again, to some extent, I'm at peace with that war. Because we're trying to change things, and we're trying to change a slightly indolent attitude towards behaviour management, the sense that children will behave if you teach them really well, which just is so untrue. You know, you can be the best teacher in the world if they're not ready to learn, and if they don't possess the behavioural skills and habits to help them to flourish in a school environment, which many children don't, through no fault of their own, then just trying to teach them is just going to run into trouble. And the reason why new teachers focus on what goes wrong, it's because that's all they can see, because I think we're probably primed to see things which are threatening and dangerous more than anything else. Experienced teachers realise that one of the best ways to get children to learn is by teaching them brilliant habits. And you know, here's what we should be doing, rather than stop doing that. But I don't blame new teachers for doing what they haven't been told not to do.
Yeah, I understood completely. Tom, the trouble with this conversation is it's been too fascinating, and I wanted to spend some time asking you about research, Ed.
But do you know what? There were other chats.
Yeah, I'm not sure we have the time, but I did want to sort of, I guess, have one question, which is, I was reflecting that when you joined Twitter and I joined Twitter at a similar time, there was this real sense that there was an establishment which was being challenged, and this was this new young community of teachers and people could have their voices heard, and it was establishing things. And I remember I feel like I'm on the outside and I'm trying to change things on the inside, and certainly I think you probably felt the same. So I suppose the interesting one now is, I mean, well, look at both of us, really. We're kind of suddenly these people who are on the outside.
David, who would have thought, not me.
You know, so you're advising the government, you've got the new behaviour network and all of that. How does that change things? What do we do to make sure there's another generation who can keep challenging things from the outside and make sure we don't become sort of the establishment conservatives, so to speak?
Oh, well, it's terribly important that we bury this new generation and we prevent them at all costs from having a voice, because we are the masters now, David. No, of course not. I think one of the ways in which we try to inoculate ourselves against calcification is something that's already happened, which is to say that the no longer new arena of social media, which has democratized and enabled so many voices from the classroom into the public arena, that it short-circuited the traditional hierarchies and priesthoods and gatekeeping which traditionally existed. Even 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, if you wanted to be heard at a serious level in terms of the national educational debate, you had to be a very, very, very senior head teacher or the leader of a union or somebody involved in that type of capacity. And if you're a teacher, well, you know, good luck to you, because your voice would reach as far back as the back of the staff room if you were lucky. But now somebody can go on social media and tweet something, and someone in Australia can think that's a great idea. That's been so brilliant, and that's been a large part of any success I or perhaps you have enjoyed, as long as hopefully having something worthwhile to say. And that continues. That process still exists, and we see wonderful new voices coming up through the network and through the pipeline, and they're voices of new levels of challenge. And some of them are people saying, I love what you're doing, and you know we should do more of it. Some of people are thinking that we should do slightly different things. But remember that the work that I think that I've tried to start out doing, and many other people, including yourself, in different ways, it's by no means finished work. It's barely begun. You know, the system is huge and it's a big ship to turn. And I know for a fact that it wouldn't take much in terms of changes in leadership for things to go back to 2004. You know, if Ofsted was to start stipulating the requirement that all children learn thematically, through project works and independently and so on, and you know that creativity was to be the one thing that was to be assessed, then you know we would go back in time quite quickly. So the levers have slightly changed over the past 5 or 10 years. We've had some successes and some inroads into better ITE, better behaviour management, better research awareness and so on, and it's been brilliant to see. But it's going to take another decade or two for this to fully flourish, and I think that project still carries on. And I think it's entirely right that we make sure that the projects that I've started, you've started, other people have started, don't simply calcify and become, you know, next year's Bruin Gym. And one of the reasons that we're very aware of that research ed is that we do have dissenting voices in the research ed communities, and people saying, well, hang on, have you thought about this? And this might be wrong and so on. And that while we do definitely try to platform some things, like, for instance, the more robust aspects of cognitive psychology, but even these themselves are not beyond challenge. And it's very important that we don't fetishize these new processes either. But until we find better ways, then we should platform them as much as we can, and perhaps as cautiously as we can, but still do so in a robust way. So it's having the true scientist approach towards your own craft, which is understanding when you've got better or worse evidence, understanding what the difference of that means, when context matters and when it doesn't, and understanding that you might always be wrong. And I think as long as you maintain that level of humility, you genuinely participate in a sincere and authentic version of the scientific process. And anything else beyond that is dogma.
Well, look, I look forward to maybe doing an interview, Nailis Natter interview with you in either 2030 or 2040, to see if in a decade or two we really have dealt with that.
Okay, well, listen, anytime, give me a chat. I know that Phil's had a hard time tracking me down, but it's been a delight to speak to you, and I hope to speak to you again in the future. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Thanks very much, Tom. Bye-bye.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast Pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast Pedagogy, listening to teachers.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, so into this week's podcast pedagogy section, starting with books. And as I speak to you on this Tuesday evening, I have just got off the phone to Tom Sherrington, talking to him about his new book, Teaching Walkthroughs with Oliver Cavigliole. And what a book this is. So I'm extremely privileged, thanks to the John Cat sponsorship of the podcast, that I am able to see releases of these books a little bit ahead of their publication. And I'll tell you what, I was absolutely blown away by this book. I haven't put it down since I got my pre-release copy. So this is a book that, as a teacher, you can use very much as a book you can read. Obviously, with Oliver's illustrations, it's extremely practical. I can also see it being a manual that you can refer back to, so something you can carry around with you on a day-to-day basis, particularly in certain sections around modelling, questioning, for example, and some of the behaviour walkthroughs that Tom and Oliver have done. But I can also see, with my senior leader hat on, that this could be a really useful discussion point for senior leadership team meetings. And they've done a section at the end about how you can implement some of the strategies that are in the book. So when I was talking to Tom about this, I asked him about the reasons why he's gone for the book and the walkthrough sections. And he talks about behaviour and routines. We talk about curriculum and how the walkthroughs can help readers design a knowledge-rich curriculum and sequencing concepts, into small steps. As you would expect from Tom and Oliver, this is steeped in research and evidence. So he's drawn on the work of Willingham, William, Berger and Shimomura, particularly in the explanation and modelling sections, but right the way through the book, this is an evidence-informed book. Tom also draws on his previous work, so he talks about Rosenshine's Principles of Instruction that came out last year, and of course the Learning Rainforest with his Mode A and Mode B teaching. And excitingly, as you listen to this podcast, research at Blackpool will be a week tomorrow. So Tom and Oliver are going to be launching the book at Research Ed Blackpool as well. So you'll be able to get the only copies, because I'm not breaking any confidences by telling you that the print run has been delayed slightly. So the only copies that will be available will be the copies that will be at Research Ed Blackpool. So get yourself down there and get a copy. I know I will be doing that. So the book is Teaching Walkthroughs by Tom Sherrington and Oliver Cavigliole, published by John Cat Educational, and will be out at Research Ed Blackpool and then on the 30th of March. Okay, so moving into other sections and back on film reviews. Now, I'd love some feedback as to whether anybody's actually interested in my thoughts on films, but as I did a podcast with Martin Rea a few weeks ago, which will be coming out pretty soon, about Teacher Five a Day, I think it's important that while we discuss education, we also talk about things outside of that. So on the Teacher hashtag Five a Day, so we're looking at Notice. So it's nice to get out and about, and this is a film that I took the children to watch, so it's Onward. And it's starring Tom Holland and Chris Pratt, amongst others. Now, this is from the Disney studio, so it starts with a Simpsons short, and it goes into the main film. So I may get this plot slightly wrong, but I did manage to stay awake for the full film, which is obviously a good thing. So the basic premise is that Ian Lightfoot never knew his father, but despite that, his dad was one of the central figures of his life. In fact, his bedroom is devoted to him, wears his dad's own clothes, listens to cassette tapes on a ghetto blaster, and Ian longs to be like his dad that he never met. Ian's older brother has got a few memories of his dad, and he treasures those memories, but the story kind of starts with Ian learned on his 16th birthday that his dad saved an extra special birthday present just for him and Barley. It's a staff with a magical stone, and one that may be able to conjure dad back into existence for 24 hours. So it does draw on sort of Harry Potter themes around magic as well. So the good bits of the film, as far as I'm concerned, is that it's got a good theme to this about, you know, the brothers and their relationship and how they kind of bond as the film goes on. It's also got some unusual sections as well, in terms of, without breaking too much of the plot, it doesn't quite work out as you think that it might do. We've also got some chase scenes. We've got some quite interesting magic scenes. We've got a little bit of hijinks and slapstick humour in there as well. What I found hard to understand is that if he could conjure magic and he could bring his father back, then I don't understand why his father would have got ill in the first place. But hey, that's just me. So, yeah, the kids quite enjoyed it. If you've got kids yourself and you're looking for a film to watch over the weekend, then I would recommend you have a look at this. So this is Disney's Onward, and that's in all cinemas and out now. Okay, moving into something that I have a bit more knowledge on. So we're into the music section now. We have a couple of listeners at my school at the moment. So listeners will be aware from Twitter of Mr. Drew Foster. Okay, and Drew listens to this podcast, believe it or not, even though he has to put up with me on a day-to-day basis. So we've been talking quite a lot about our musical collections and our love of vinyl. So for listeners of the same vintage as us, you'll remember this album the first time round. For listeners that maybe a little bit younger, maybe you don't. So a recommendation for Portishead's Dummy, which was their 1994 debut album. So if you like your tempo slow, your drums crisp, and your keyboards smooth, then this album is definitely for you. And it's so much more than background music that I alluded to in the introduction. So you've got Beth Gibbons singing like a 1990s Billie Holiday with an all-pervasive gloom, which certainly suited me in 1994 and pretty much sometimes does now as well. So like I said, it's not a chill-out album, and the lyrics to this, a lot of the songs are quite cutting at parts. But the constituents of the album are quite easy to trace. So you've got a lot of soul, hip-hop, scratch effects, loops and samples of this. And you can kind of see the influence that Portishead have had through the years on other bands. For example, I'm quite a big fan of the XX. You can see that lineage through their work. So this album, of course, is best listened to on vinyl. And I would like to listen to it as one set piece, sequentially as presented. So rather than just sampling one of the highlights, so Glory Box, for example, you can get on Apple Music, but invest in the vinyl, get yourself a turntable, listen to it as it was intended to be. So if you're a younger listener who has no idea what I'm talking about, check out Portishead's defining work, without doubt one of the greatest debut albums of the 1990s. So that is Portishead's Dummy, and it's available pretty much everywhere on vinyl. Okay, moving into the shameless plugs section, and we're going to do shameless plugs for upcoming podcasts rather than upcoming speaking events, because as listeners will know, I had some car issues last week, and I was really sorry to Claire Stoneman that I wasn't able to go to Research Ed Birmingham. It looked like a fantastic event. The car, well, slightly better this week, so hopefully I might be able to just do the short journey down to Research Ed Blackpool. If not, I can get on the bus. Anyway, so shameless plugs we're talking about are for upcoming podcasts. So next week, as I've mentioned a few times, we have Teacher Head Tom Sherrington on Teacher Walkthroughs. We also continue our focus on behaviour, and we have Paul Dix talking about When the Adults Change, Everything Changes. So that's coming up in a couple of weeks' time. And we also have the fantastic Daisy Christodoulou, whose podcast with Craig Barton I listened to. It was fantastic. And Daisy was great to interview last week, so that'll be coming out fairly soon as well. Also a plug for the newly revamped, hopefully it'll be out by now, nailersnatter.co.uk. So I've got some external expertise, as you should always do with a good CPD program and a website, it turns out, to design the website a little bit better for me, so you can access all the archive episodes if you're new to the podcast on the website, which should have a bit more, but a bit of a better look and a nicer feel and easier to access. So it just remains for me to say thank you again to David Weston, thank you to Tom Bennett, and thank you all for listening to Nailers Natter. See you again next time.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.